Okay, so you'll notice already the sort of convoluted title for today, which implies we'll be dealing with two questions, one nested inside the other. The internal question, may I employ gene editing, is a fascinating modern question. It kind of dovetails well with some of the other modern technology and halakha topics that we've been looking at. You know, outer space and lab grown meat and all of these things. So this dovetails very well within that family of topics. But the, you know, the meta question, the framing question is may I employ gene editing itself a halakhic question? Meaning, is it subject to halakhic kinds of analysis, which we've mostly been using in previous kinds of topics? We'll try to avoid being, like, overly theoretical. There are people who do that for a living, and it's fun, but it is important, I think, when tackling new questions, to think not only about, like, what the substance of the answers is going to be, but also what modes of thought are we even using to think about new questions? And are they the right modes? Do they fit the data? So we'll look at the broader question second, but starting with the local question first. So there are a couple of, I guess, values at play in thinking about a question like, may I employ gene editing? Some of which we'll see reflected in our traditional sources. But let's spitball a little bit. Right? What issues, what values, what concerns might come up in thinking about editing genes? Or actually, can we do a quick background into defining what we're talking about?
In regards to what?
Editing genes.
Editing genes?
Editing genes.
Well, there are specific sequences of amino acids in DNA, which I noticed you very cleverly put on the blocks the baby's reaching for. That's great.
No, in the bottom right corner, there's Shutterstock, and oh, okay. I probably could get the AI to put a logo like Shutterstock in the corner of an image,
okay.
But I did not.
It might do it on its own because it's trained.
Right, that's true, that's true. Okay, anyway, so give us a little scientific background.
So there are sequences of letters. The letters aren't actual letters. They represent different kinds of amino acids, and each sequence of three codes for a specific kind of protein. So when it gets red, it goes make this kind of protein, whatever that means. And so different sets of sequences will represent different kinds of genes. So it's not just one sequence, really. Sometimes it's just one, but sometimes it's a combination of different ones that will represent a different sort of genetic thing from showing up. The color of your hair may not be one specific one. It could be multiple. I believe the color of your skin is actually seven different sets that determines exactly what different aspects of that are.
Okay. All right, so that's a great background, you know, reminder about DNA and genetics, and the theory behind gene editing.
Presumably gene editing would be using specific enzymes to cut sections of DNA off and then inserting.
That's the name of
this. Yeah, so I would have memorized the acronym and told you if it would have meant anything to me or anything to most of you to remember what CRISPR stands for. But that's one of the genetic tools that apparently exists in some bacteria, and we found ways of manipulating to work in human beings that basically takes, you know, your DNA, your genome, and is able to cut it in certain places and then have your body repair it in ways that we want. So if a person has, let's say, black hair and would like to change it to brown hair, and we're able to find all the genes that control for your hair color, we can change all of them and then change your hair color as a result. There are some pieces of... There's actually a lot of the science that I wish I knew more about, but there's only so much I was able to do. Like, for example, right, your hair color is controlled by genes all over your body, but specifically, I would imagine the ones
every
like
cell
that
in your
by
body,
your hair
every
that
cell
make
in your body
hair.
Is the same set of DNA.
Right, so do I have to change all of your cells?
Which part is active and which
so
part
really the only feasible way to do this would be when you're dealing with just a single cell?
Yeah.
So my understanding is that isn't the case. My understanding is that there are ways of doing this to at least groups of cells. So for example, I was reading about a gene treatment that exists that handles, I think, sickle cell anemia, and they're able to modify like large amounts of bone marrow to get it to produce the right kinds of proteins, or something along those lines. But a simple example would be taking a fetus, which has a very small number of cells, and modifying those, and then when they replicate, they'll just replicate exactly as they exist. Okay, so... And the goal is, I mean, there might be many goals, and we'll talk about some of the things you might try to accomplish using this treatment or technology. But now that we know that this is a thing that basically is possible and will become more possible and more accessible over time, what are some values, concerns, advantages that they might want to think about in whether one may employ gene editing or not. Maybe it's too broad a question.
Are you playing God in doing this?
Are you playing God? That's a phrase people like to quote. Are you playing God? What do people mean when they say playing God? That's like a fuzzy phrase.
So I would say, for me it means, in doing these things, are you going beyond, are you making changes beyond, what I would say, if you want me to tell you, are you going into areas that are maybe not what human beings should be playing around with? And that's should be left in God's hands. Those questions obviously are very difficult because anything related to making someone's health better, you know,
right.
Dark hair. I want to have a baby with blonde hair. I don't want dark hair. Okay, so that would to be like okay.
So I think you were actually combining two different concerns, which are both real concerns. Right? One is, are there areas of scientific development that are not meant for humans to engage in at all? That there's certain things that we leave in God's hands that we don't get involved with. And the second concern you raise is whether it will be used towards proper means. Right? So is designing your baby itself like a bad thing for some reason? Right? Just, you know, for example, you could imagine a world, certainly many cultures you can imagine, if people had the choice of, let's say, what sex their baby would be, you might have people strongly preferring boys, strongly preferring girls. Would you want to live in a world where people could choose, and whatever biases people have in favor of whatever kinds of kids they want to have would be reflected in the actual population of kids that exist?
I mean, people already do that, just in a different way. I think it was... I don't know. Is it China? Was there a limited amount of kids they're allowed to have? So they want to only have boys because the boys stay part of the family when they get married, and so they'll just keep having abortions until the baby is the gender they want it to be.
So it's true, right? We can distinguish between the tool that we're using, where we might ask questions like, "Is this a tool that human beings are meant to use?" and the goal that we're using the tool for, right? If gene editing is a really evil tool, but we're using it just to save people's lives from terrible disease, that's a different conversation than if the tool itself is really great and like a fulfillment of our creative potential, but we're using it for essentially eugenics. Like there are ways to think about both of these factors kind of in parallel. Okay, so let's look at some of the concerns that have been floated. And we'll notice something about the genre of these texts in a little bit, but let's first just look at the substance of them. And part of the reason why the question, I think, was vaguely worded at the beginning is because we can talk about editing genes of different kinds of organic matter. So we can talk about plants, for example, and that's where our first source might come in. This is a passage from the Ramban on Chumash in discussing the Isser of Kilayim, which a subset of which is what we call shatnez, like mixing different fibers in clothing, but there's a whole swath of mixing different kinds of plants in the ground, mixing different seeds, and then in turn mixing different animals. And Ramban says that what appears to be a programmatic statement about how to think about our like technological role in the world, specifically vis-a-vis kilayim. And he says, hatam b'kilayim, the reason is not what Rashi said, which is that it's just a chok. There's no reason for it at all. It's just an arbitrary manifestation of God's will. For Ramban, there's a reason. Ki Hashem bara haminim ba'olam b'chol ba'alei hanafashot b'tzomchim u'v'ba'alei nefesh hatenua. God created all the different species of all of the living things, plants and animals. And he gives them means of procreation. So there are trees, and the trees will have baby trees. And God commanded that they should each reproduce in accordance with their own species. Liminehem. And that's a term you see in Bereishit, he mentions. So this is the idea behind prohibiting kilayim, interbreeding animals or interbreeding plants. And then we'll just jump down a line to the second to last line in the Hebrew. V'hamarkiv shnei minim, one who combines two different species, mishana u'machish b'maseh bereshit. He changes and contradicts the work of creation. Strong language. Ki'ilu yachshov, as if you think, shalo hishlem HaKadosh Baruch Hu be'olamo kol HaTorech. It's as though God didn't create a good enough world. There aren't enough kinds of corn out there. I'm going to make a different kind of corn that's bred exactly the way I want it. And the world that God gave me isn't good enough. I want to help God along a little bit, give him an extra hand. This is close, not exactly the same as the concern about playing God, but I think it falls close to that idea. That there are certain ideas about the organization of animals, organization of plant life, that are immutable, or at least immutable by people. We're not meant to change them, only God has control over these species. And red, in the most extreme sense, this is a strong argument against pretty much any intervention in nature. Don't get involved because God created a good enough world. We think the world that God created wasn't good enough. It's a very hard and bold claim to make. Before we look at a theological response to this, anyone notice something like scientifically troublesome about this Rambam? About the way he describes plant life and animal life?
I mean, we're doing selective crop growing, basically all of agriculture.
Right, so first of all, right, like the fact that I'm breeding, you know, strawberries today do not look like the strawberries looked like 5,000 years ago. They're much more massive and they're much sweeter. So already we do that. Even if we don't mix breeds, we're still changing the form of different things. Maybe even more essentially, the Rambam here and other sources that take this kind of approach assume that species are like a super rigid thing. Whereas people who believe in evolution will tell you that the idea of species being this like fixed thing that God put into nature, all the species that exist, we know that kind of that shifts over time, and the kinds of, you know, dogs and mammals that exist now were not necessarily around millions of years ago. So we can even ask the question before we talk about like a theological response to this source, just saying, does the argument hold up if we have a new conception of nature? Right? For the Rishonim, nature was a much more fixed, rigid system. If we know it to be more dynamic, maybe that changes already our role or our ability or permission to integrate with it. I think as a way of thinking about the question becomes very interesting. On a more theological level, in the second source, we have a really, I think it's like a dramatic dialogue. You don't see a ton of this in Midrashic writing. You see some of it. And you see in this dialogue, and again, many other sources like it, kind of an opposite thesis to Ramban about how to think about the work of creation. So it's recorded here in the Midrash Tanhuma and other places. Ma'aseh sheshal Turnus Rufus harasha at Rabbi Akiva. So Turnus Rufus, a certain Roman general, started interrogating Rabbi. You started reading ahead, or
it just sounds like a dinosaur.
Turnus Rufus. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So he asked Rabbi Akiva, "Ezo ma'asim na'im? Shall HaKadosh Baruch Hu or shall Basar Adam? Whose works are greater, God's works or man's works?" And Rabbi Akiva says, man's works. That's puzzling. You expect the rabbi to say that God can do better work than we can, and when you think about the work that God did, it generally does seem to be better than the work that we can. But Returnus Rufus follows up, you know, God created the heavens and the earth. What are you talking about? Well, Rabbi Akiva responds, and this version of the source, oh no, he does have it. Maybe he responds, okay, well, you tell me, what's better, wheat or bread? And Turnus Rufus said, well, bread is obviously better. It's much more fun to eat. He says, okay, so look, there's something that God created, but that man was able to make a better version of. Now, obviously, you'll put in parentheses, like God could have made bread directly and chose not to and gave us the ability to do so. But the works that actually exist, that people create, tend to be better, at least for us, than the works that God necessarily created in the background of nature. And the reason this Midrash comes on Parshat Tzriya is that the theological comparison they're making is to Bris Milah, where boys are born. They're born in some sort of imperfect state, and then on the eighth day, we have to improve them somehow. We have to do extra work on them. How can we do that? What's the logic behind that? The logic seems to be that God created a world that is lacking in some way for us to build on. And this source, reflecting this Midrash and other Midrashim, it's worth reading the dialogue as a whole. It's kind of powerful just as a story. Pushes back very strongly against Rabban's thesis. Rabban says, don't change creation, you're denying God's authority, you're denying God's power or wisdom or something along those lines. And sources like that Midrash and the commentaries who cite it would say, no, we're given room to make a tikkun in the world. We have a world that exists, and one of our jobs is to improve that world. I think in a previous iteration of this, we talked about Rav Soloveitchik's like approval of a human scientific endeavor and conquest. And for him, it was in the context of the space race in particular, but in broader human endeavor in general. We exist on this world to improve it and to gain dominion and mastery over it. And that pushes very strongly against that kind of theological argument. So if you want to think, let's say, just on the level of plants and animals, we have a theological concern we could raise. There's also a version of this as a halakhic concern, because if I mix, you know, genes from one plant with genes of another plant, you could ask whether that's, forget the philosophy of kilayim. Maybe that's actually kilayim. If I merge, you know, genes from strawberries into my pineapple to make red pineapple, which sounds great.
No, it doesn't.
No, it sounds great. You would love it.
No.
Okay. We'll work on this. If I can persuade you of one thing this year, but anyway, so maybe that itself is like, you know, mixing different species. So commentaries deal with that issue, or contemporary authorities rather deal with that issue on a substantive level. Okay, so concern number one is a plain God concern. If we move focus to human beings, so we could talk about medical applications. I mentioned one, but there are plenty of other applications that exist. And those seem to be probably among the less controversial applications here. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find someone who would tell you that I could give you a medicinal therapy, but I couldn't give you a gene therapy. That would be an inappropriate breach of human, medical authority. You see the source, for example, source number three, Tana Debeir of Ishmael, and this is quoted extensively in medical halachic literature. When the Torah says, Virapo yerape, he shall surely be healed. Mikan shenitan reshut larofe lerapo. A physician is given permission, so to speak, to heal. And now, the background question here is, well, why do I need permission to do that? It seems kind of like an intuitive human behavior. I should heal people who are sick. The Tosfot here gives one thesis that dovetails nicely with what we saw before. The Tosfot on that Gemara comment, v'im tomar, v'ham me rapo l'chudei shemin anai. Why do you need two words, or po yirape, to say rapo, and I would know that you could heal someone. V'yesh lomar, I would have thought, dehava mina hani mili maka bide adam. If a person hits another person, which is what the context of those psukim in the Torah is, so then you could heal them, right? You caused the damage, you could fix the damage that you caused. However, aval choli haba bidei shamayim, kishemarape nira kesoter gzeret hamelech. Maybe if God causes someone to be sick, well now, you're not undoing your own work, you're undoing God's work. You're soter gzeret hamelech, you're contradicting the decree of the king, capital K. So how could you do that? Kamash malan, dishari. The second word in that phrase, rapo yirape, teaches you could even undo God's work. So, dovetailing well with at least what the Ramban thought initially, maybe there's a certain idea that we should be respecting God's choices in the world. When people become sick, they become sick. But we seem to have a pretty explicit source here, that's again quoted very extensively, saying no, there really is a much wider license to use medical applications. So, the most practical, I think, applications in gene editing are probably in agriculture, to be honest. They're in developing the kinds of foods that will sustain large numbers of people, especially more resilient kinds of foods. But coming, you know, close second place would be these medical applications, which would probably be among the least controversial of the ones that we might learn about. The third is the one that I think, when people first hear about these and think about like the ethical dilemmas, they're thinking about this, which is the question of gene editing on babies, and specifically for non-medical reasons. It might be a little bit hard to say, you know, if you have a fetus that's going to have some genetic illness and you could change that, it'd be a little hard to argue that you shouldn't do that. But what about non-medical things? I could make a baby that is predisposed to be a little bit smarter, or a little bit taller, or maybe, like, nicer, or more likely to be religious, assuming there are genes that control for all of these things, which we'll assume for the moment. So what about that? So, in this story in the Agadata in Masechet Brachot, we see a little bit of allusion to this. And this seems to be a precedent, but we'll unpack it together and show why it might not be the strongest piece here. Amarle, this is in the context of a dialogue between Chizkiyahu, who's one of the kings in the end of Sefer Malachim, and Yeshayahu, who is a prophet at the same time. By reading these stories, when you study either Sefer Malachim or Sefer Yeshayahu, it's a fun like crossover, because you're like learning Malachim and you're seeing the stories of the kings, and all of a sudden like one of your favorite Nevi'im shows up. And he's like, you know, had a little episode where he gets to interact with all your favorite characters.
It's like,
yeah, it's a crossover. It's really great when you look at those chapters in Malachim or in Yeshayahu. But anyway, so they're having this dialogue. Chizkiyahu had fallen ill, and he spoke to the Navi to find out why. Amarle, my kulei hai, why am I ill? Amarle mishum delo asakta prier urvia. You did not strive to have children. Amarle, I'm not, you know, completely like rejecting this mitzvah. It's an important mitzvah. Mishum dechazayli beruach hakodesh. I had a divine inspiration. Dinafku minai bivinyan delo malu. I would, sorry, Bivnin, Benin Delom Malu. I knew that my kids were not going to be righteous, so why should I bring not righteous children into this world? And this is the key line. Amarlei Yishayahu responded, Behade Kavshe Derachmana Lamalach. These secrets, these hidden, hidden knowledge from God, why are you getting involved in all of that? Your job, as someone who's being commanded to keep mitzvot, is to do the mitzvot. It's up to God if your kid's going to be righteous or not righteous. That's his concern and not yours. Your job is to do your duty, your obligation, and have children. And the story goes on, how he wanted to marry Yahya's daughter, and, you know, interesting stories for Sefer Malachim. Don't turn the page. Okay, so right now, you could take this Gemara, and some do, to mean, oh, clearly you're not meant to examine too closely your future children and try to, you know, preclude problems that might arise from them. Don't get involved, don't think about this. Okay, is this a good precedent? Why not? There are several reasons, and we'll see a few of them.
I mean, this it was because he didn't get to that point. Because he thought it was going to be bad, he didn't go in that direction in the first place.
Okay, so first of all, you're saying, once he was going to have a kid, right, once his wife is pregnant, well, you're not going to kill him, so can you fix it? But you could choose, maybe in advance, not to get pregnant in the first place.
This is saying don't choose in the first place.
Right, but you're saying if he had already, let's say he was married, his wife already was pregnant, then you would say at that point,
and if he,
and he still knew that the kid was going to be wicked and had some way of changing that,
yeah,
then maybe he could change that. Great, that's one reason it might not be a great precedent. There are a bunch.
Teaching your kids. If you're going to claim that you don't have the right to decide or to control if your kid ends up being good or bad, then you could say you don't have the right to try and teach your kid good things because, you know, Hashem decides how they end up.
What's the line, right? You're supposed to raise your kids in a certain way.
Yeah.
You have values. So where's the line? You know, you can only do work on them after they're born. When they're three, like, you have to find a way to draw the lines.
Well, you're changing how the kid is. You know, you're changing how much they know, or how much whatever, how much they know about Judaism, how religious they are by teaching them things. No, you can't do that. You can make that argument.
You can definitely make that argument. Other concerns? Yeah.
In this case, he's specifically going against a mitzvah. You could argue that editing genes has nothing to do with a baris or mitzvos. I mean, maybe it does.
Right, well, we've been struggling a little bit to find, like, a strong answer to that question, but you're right, that, you know, here I have an explicit, like, unambiguous obligation versus whatever values I have. Well, when it comes to unambiguous obligations versus values, obligations win. But, again, here we're talking about giving your kid a better life. We're not changing any of your, you know, existing obligations. Okay, these are all great. Actually, I think none of them were ones that had been anticipated in source number 6, but there are a few other concerns. So, for example, and I'll summarize some of the points outside, we're not going to read them all, but there are a number of interpretations of this Gemara that maybe limit the application to our issues. So, for example, Chizkiyahu is a king. Well, what happens when a king doesn't have kids?
The line dies.
Yeah, you...
Crisis.
So maybe you have a massive political crisis, and the dynasty ends, and who knows what's going to be. Most other people don't have kids. The consequences are less dire. So it's not about the mitzvah, it really is about another transcendent value, but it's a very important value of maintaining political stability. That's one reason that maybe the extension doesn't go that far. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky is quoted here in the third paragraph. Maybe he was wrong, right? If you know for certain that the kid's going to be wicked, that's great, but we don't know for certain. Menashe, in fact, later in his life, does tshuva. It's recorded in Sefer Divrei HaYamim. So if you knew really all the information, maybe you could make changes, but you're making speculative decisions. You know, when we read someone's genes, we have, I think, a much more certain knowledge of what's going to happen to them in their lives, or at least what their predispositions might be in the background. So maybe that's another reason the precedent doesn't necessarily work. And so in trying to extrapolate from a single source like that, you know, a broad principle about what changes you are or are not allowed to make in a fetus, seems like we're going to be a little bit stuck. And that, I think that plus the earlier observation about the way that mitzvot relate to, you know, values decisions, I think transitions us to our second piece in the shiur, which I hope we should have a third piece, but I think we're probably not going to get there. So the second piece is, okay, how do we think about questions like this in general? Like, what are our background models for thinking about this? And the reason I think it's a question that needs to be asked explicitly, and especially with questions like gene editing, is that with halacha that kind of already exists, we know the role halacha plays, right? I know there are halachot for Yom Tov, and I know what those halachot are, and I don't expect them to radically change or encounter radically new circumstances anytime soon. But this is a new thing. And when you encounter a new thing, so you might wonder, well, I have a fixed number of books on my shelf, right? Like, the Torah is deep, and there's a lot of it, and it's not really possible to master all of it, but I could take every single physical book that had ever been written about Torah and put them on a shelf, and it would be a finite number of books. And it might be that this particular topic is not actually in those books. So that might lead a person to think, and maybe correctly, I'm not trying to bias the conversation, that perhaps we're thinking about this incorrectly if we're trying to think about it in halachic terms. The source that I think most concisely articulates something like this is source number 7. This is the Tiferet Yisrael. It's a commentary on a Mishnah. We actually used him a little bit. He had earlier comments about dinosaurs earlier this year, but here he's being much more true to his calling. She'kol davar shelo neida ta'am la'osro. Any matter that we know no reason to prohibit, mutar hu bli ta'am, is permitted without any reason. Delo hizkira ha-Torah dvarim hamutarim kulam. The Torah does not list all the permitted things from which you can infer all the prohibited things. Rather, rak dvarim ha-asurim. It lists a bunch of prohibitions, a bunch of restrictions, and then you can infer that anything not restricted by the Torah is automatically permitted, automatically legitimate. So, if I can't open a single book of halacha and find a statement about gene editing, that could lead me to a default position from which there's no halachic answer to this question. Halacha does not really care, and by implication, anything that you would want to do is permitted. And there's one approach you could take with new halachic issues. I was trying to find this quote. It was from a prominent 20th century posek. I couldn't remember which one. If I could, I probably could have found it. About cloning. And I think this posek was asking about cloning, and he said the Torah has nothing to say about this. Torah doesn't know from cloning, so the Torah can't tell you that it's permitted, it can't tell you that it's valuable, it can't tell you it's prohibited, it's just not something that's dealt with by the Torah system. Happens to be, there is precedent for that conversation, but the approach that is being demonstrated is one in which halakha has like a fixed scope, more or less, it covers the things that it covers, and other things are not included in it yet. Now, question, or no. Just chewing on the idea, okay? Right, so... What?
A bad joke that I thought of, and no.
And pause the recording. No, it's okay, it's okay.
No, bad is...
Like, morally bad. Like, you
no.
shouldn't have thought of it.
No.
No, okay.
Bad is just, it's a bad pun.
Oh, let's leave it be. Okay. Now, it could be, by the way, that even in a world in which there is no existing halacha about this, that doesn't mean that there'll be nothing, like, Jewishly meaningful to say about it. And you could say in one of two different ways. So, for example, in this quote from Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, he argues that there are certain areas that are not covered by halacha, but that are obviously religiously meaningful in some way. Right? They're not covered by halacha and therefore irrelevant. If we mean that everything can be looked up, every moral dilemma resolved by reference to code or canon, the notion is both palpably naive and patently false. The Chazon Ish, for one, and both his saintliness and his rigorous halakhic commitment are legend, had no such illusions. Moral duties, he once wrote, sometimes constitute one corpus with halakhic rulings, and it is halakha that defines the prescribed and permitted of ethical thought. Sometimes, but not evidently always, there are moments when one must seek independent counsels. And I think that last line is the critical line I'm trying to highlight. You can find formulations like this in a million different sources, that just because a thing is not covered by halakha does not mean that it's not covered by Judaism writ large, Torah writ large. You might find a bunch of philosophical values that are relevant to this conversation, like the ones we started this conversation with. Or, and this is not something we usually do, but we have tons of examples of halacha accommodating new realities, or at least changing. For example, anytime you've heard of a rabbinic law, it's because there was a Torah, and there was a halacha that included certain things, and never included a mitzvah to light candles of any kind. And then, 1,000 years later, all of a sudden, there's a mitzvah of lighting candles. Halacha changed, in the sense that we were able to institute new legislation. So there is room within halakha to institute legislation. And you can imagine a halakhic authority saying, theoretically, gene editing should be mutter, but we should make, you know, the equivalent of a gzera and prohibit it being used. It gets into legal questions of whether nowadays we have the authority to legislate gzeras, but assume for the moment that's like a model that we could borrow. We could expand halakha to fit the new reality. Consciously, we know what we're doing. We know that halakha doesn't cover it, but we know that we want it to, so let's be explicit. Let's add to the rules. You know, we pass an amendment and change the rules for gene editing. That's one way to think about it. Or that's right. One way to think about it is by invoking values. Two is by thinking about expanding halakha. A third way to think about it, which is discussed here in source number 9, is just some of the practical considerations. Meaning, something might be permitted in theory, but not permitted in practice. What these authors, including Rav Moshe Tendler, who's a major authority in medical halakha, or was, he passed away a few years ago, is that practically, you know, we want to be a little hesitant about the science. So he argues that for any medical purpose, the, you know, if we know the medicine well enough to know that it's going to basically be for a person or a child's benefit, so we're allowed to do that. But for more aesthetic things, you know, changing the gender, the hair color, or the athleticism of the child, so we're not confident enough in the technology to be able to use it. So we're gonna hold off, right? It's not formally expanding halacha. We're acknowledging the reality, and we're employing standard issues like, you know, sveiko. We're not sure whether this is dangerous or not. We're gonna take our feet off the gas while we kind of figure it out. And if the reality changes, these authors argue, then maybe we should reevaluate that. But for the time being, we're gonna hold off on making those kinds of radical changes. Because you have no idea what it's gonna do, right? We have not had children who have lived full lifetimes after having their genes edited when they were in utero. So we don't know what happens over the course of a lifetime or over multiple lifetimes. So we're going to be sort of pragmatically cautious. That's one approach. The second approach is probably the most classic halakhic answer, right? When you have a new halakhic data where there's no explicit precedent, and that's you try to find the closest precedent you can and you borrow from it. I know what the halakha is in the case of meat that falls from the sky. So I'm going to try to extrapolate from that what it should be for meat that we grow in a lab. Or meat that we created with Sefer Yetzirah, so meat that we grow in a lab. So we might be able to do that here too, except as we saw, some of the precedent that we have is not strictly legal, nor necessarily strictly applicable, right? Can we learn from Chizkiyahu? Well, that's a narrative text, it's not a legal text, so I already don't know what I could extrapolate. And even if I could extrapolate from that text, maybe I would only limit it to kings. Maybe I would limit it to more certain knowledge than we have. So it would be hard to come to really definitive conclusions based on precedent unless you have very good precedent. You might have good precedent, but that requires a lot of work. In what I saw, I didn't see a ton of very clear precedent about some of these questions. With regard to like the plant questions, like chelation issues, there's more clear evidence as to, you know, whether mixing genes counts as mixing plants. But with regard to the thornier ethical issues, it's a little bit sparser. And finally, the third model, which is the one I'm most excited about, but it would be better if I could demonstrate it, but I can't demonstrate it because it's a hard issue to demonstrate this with. And this is the one in source number 10. This is an essay by Rabbi Ezra Bick, who basically, he tries to deal with this issue as it appeared 30 years ago. This was a question about, I'm sure it was a real question, like practical question he was dealing with, but he's dealing with the topic of maternity, specifically when you have an egg donor and then a surrogate. And so the question the post-gum will have to deal with is, well, if you have an egg donor and a surrogate, is it the one whose genetic material created the child that's the mother? Or is it the surrogate who's the mother? Or are they both the mother? Or does the kid not have a mother? Like, there are different possibilities that get thrown around. And classical halakhic reasoning would follow the second path we took. Right? Halakha has something to say about it. Let me find all these little, you know, hints or allusions to issues like this and try to draw, you know, formal legal extrapolations. What Rabik does is says, that's not a way that we can think about some of these issues. There's not clear enough precedent. The issues were not relevant at the time that major halakhic works were being composed and major halakha was being developed. So we have to do the work on our own. Essentially, he says, this question is not susceptible to the classical halakhic approach of analogy with an existent halakhic ruling. Not only does a preponderance of halakhic sources not exist in favor of parturition as a maternal determinant. Practically speaking, no halakhic sources exist for this or any competing candidate for the determinant. A different approach must therefore be attempted. And what he describes is, we can't keep digging for a source when there is no source. Usually, he says, we would follow the principle of the Mishnah, Mesechta Avot, Hafuchba, Hafuchba, Dechula, but keep digging in the Torah and you'll find something eventually. He says, you can keep digging, but what if you don't find something eventually? So what you need to do is try to think about how Chazal would have thought about this question if they had encountered this question. Jumping to, really, the last line is a great, very concise formulation of this idea. It appears to me that we are justified in trying to determine the Talmudic assumptions, the base conceptions of the Talmudic worldview, from other sources. For those who have studied more Gemara, this is something that he would argue is very familiar. Anytime you have, you know, a difficult Mishnah or a contradiction, and you resolve it by invoking some, like, legal principle, right? No one that's not formally attested to in the Torah. It's not like you quote a pasuk. When you quote a pasuk, okay, God gave authority to that text, I'm deferring to it. But oftentimes, we resolve difficult issues by invoking, you know, legal ideas. There's a presumption that this is in fact a reality, and so we're allowed to do, you know, this thing. Things like chazakot, legal presumptions, that the reality has not changed from how it's been. There's no, that's a bad example, there's a source in the Torah for that. But most of the time when we invoke legal principles, they're from legal reasoning that the authorities in Chazal were trying to employ, and we're justified in trying to employ legal reasoning as well in thinking about questions like this. An argument like this gives us a lot more leeway to, maybe the term is create halacha, meaning what Rabbi might argue is that there's no halacha about gene editing. That doesn't mean there can't be halacha about gene editing. It means we have to study a lot of Torah and study, you know, halacha as it's developed, and think about how could we think about this? Could we, you know, construct or imagine a prohibition here? If so, what would the scope of that prohibition be? And it's a lot more creative, not because it isn't based on real deep knowledge of text and Torah, but because you're going places that you would argue have not actually been developed before. Meaning you're coming to new halakhic ideas that are not just the halakhic idea of the previous text applied to the situation, but actually a new halakhic principle that will come to address a situation like this. I feel bad here because I'm presenting what for me is a really like compelling vision of how a great halakhic authority could think about thorny halakhic issues, but I'm not a great halakhic authority, so I can't demonstrate it. Like, I wish I could show how, you know, background halakhic assumptions could come to give you real clear guidance on questions like the ones that we're dealing with. But that's the direction I think that we could go, or that halacha, you know, descriptively could go in trying to deal with some of the issues that we've talked about today. Okay, it's 8:45, so let me actually pause. I'll leave this to you. Okay, so we decided we're going to continue and look at one treatment about gene editing. This is from Rav Shlomo Aviner. Rav Shlomo Aviner is a very prominent religious Zionist figure in Israel, religious Zionist halachic figure in Israel. Politically also on the right. We're not going to look at his political positions now, but in terms of halachic or, you know, religious authority, he certainly is a major voice on the Israeli scene. And he was asked in this piece, it's an article in the journal Asia, which is a journal of medical halacha, Ma yasas yachascha, what is your relationship or your approach to kapi dvarim ha-madaniyim she-kaniren nimta ha-gen ha-merkazi ha-gorim le-dika'on? The scientists have said that they found the main gene that's responsible for dikaon, which I assume is anxiety. Uvakarov, and soon, yimaseha jen hagorein letiyah hadatit. And soon, you'll find the gene that is responsible for being religiously inclined. People might be genetically predisposed to be more religious or less religious. Vechein, hajen hamerkazi hamashpia ala intelligentsia. The ones that impact your intelligence. So there are two questions that he's dealing with. Number one, Ech dvarim elu mityashvim im yisorotayim shal ha'emuna b'chlal, v'shal ha'bechira ha'chofshit v'aschar v'onish b'frat. How do these things relate to emuna, belief in general, and specifically belief in things like free will? Right? If we find genes that are really predispose you to intelligence, to virtue, so does that imply a limit on free will? Are we not really free in deciding whether we're going to be religious or not? And number two, Mahi haityachasut halachatit li'isuk b'hendasai genetit. What is the halachic approach to dealing with this issue? So he responds, he says, I'm not really so sure that there's going to be a gene that correlates to religiosity, and I don't know if there is. But anyway, it's not going to be a big problem. And these were these two questions in order. First, the philosophical, then the halachic. I think even that itself is a little bit reflective of what is the more important or the more, you know, the easier issue to tackle. The halachic issue is much harder to tackle. It's easier to start with the philosophical implications. So in the source here, he says, in the third paragraph on the page, Hebet Machshavti, a philosophical approach. He says, "Ein klal stira bein haruchosh hageneti shel ha'adam." There is no contradiction between a person's genetic inheritance, hakoveya bo tchunot misuyamot, which gives him certain traits or tendencies, lebein habechira chofshit, between that and free will. He says, "Why?" Because he says that the Rambam, who's a big proponent of free will in his Mishneh Torah, he also says that people are born with certain traits. Some people are born particularly prone to worry. Some people are born particularly carefree, and people are born stingier, and people are born more generous, I guess. Not exactly an antonym there. And so on and so forth. And the value, as he describes in this section, is... the line that begins, Yit'ameit, which is seven lines from the bottom of the paragraph, Le'umatzut, despite the fact that a person is born with whatever tendencies they have, Afa mochshar, even if you have certain predispositions, im yitatzel lo yegi alaklon. You could be lazy, even if you're predisposed to being very wise. If you're lazy, you're not going to accomplish anything. Ulefum tzara agra. In accordance with the work is the reward. So at the end of the day, you can have any predisposition you want, and you still have free will within the context of your dispositions. So you're born with whatever tendencies you have, and then as soon as you become, you know, morally responsible, you have to work on yourself and work on those tendencies. And so he says, if you could imagine a situation where a person could improve someone's character, all that does is shift the scope of their free will to a different range. So it used to be that I had to have a real moral dilemma about whether I was going to steal or not. If you could edit my genes so I no longer felt the disposition to stealing, I would have another moral dilemma that I would need to grapple with. And he refuses to believe, and I think this is generally the case if you're going to believe in free will in a world where you believe in genetics, the genetics are destiny. Where you're going to have to reject the idea that if you have certain genes, you're automatically going to be this way. And you could assume if you have a predisposition, but something within your ability to change, then you still have preserved free will in the world. And just, you know, to borrow a mashal that he's not invoking here, if you ever heard of the phrase, the nikudat ha-bechira from Rav Dessler, right? You have a certain range of acceptable options for you. You're not going to murder anyone anytime soon. You're also probably not going to donate all your money to charity. Well, if I shift your genes so you're more likely to do that, that gets into your window, and, you know, punching someone in the face is now out of your window. And you keep sliding it around. So I assume he's invoking a certain idea along these lines. And that's mostly the substance of his approach here. He does a little bit more work in trying to establish precedent for the idea that you could be born with certain predispositions from the world of astrology, which was relevant to a lot of classical commentaries, but we'll leave that to the side now to get to his halachic approach. So that's the page, it's not page 45 of the sources, but on the top of the page is number 45. Okay. She'ilat heter ha'isuk b'handasa genetit hi chadasha b'olam ha'halacha. The question of using genetic engineering is new in the halachic world. And it is a weighty topic. It is a weighty question. Elohim shnei minukim, nimukim. These are two issues. Shekol echad mehem, meaning the following, what he's going to invoke, are two issues that each of which, dayo kedei lechayev ha'oraz zo, lo tia netuna biyad kol echad, are enough to obligate that any ruling on this issue can't be left to any individual, el rak bidei gedolei hador. Can only be left to the greatest of each generation, which we didn't talk about this in dealing with like the halachic theory piece, but whatever your halachic approach is, you could then ask a halachic process question, which is who's allowed to have an opinion about this? Can anyone, if there's no clear halachic ruling about this, can anyone develop a halachic intuition for what should be, or do we leave it in the authority of the gedolim? So Rav Aviner and many others like him say, we need questions like this, you can't have everyone deciding on their own. You need to have halacha being developed here by only the greatest minds. So what are his two limitations? Limitation number one that he invokes is... I don't know if he has two in the end. Okay. Limitation number one that he invokes is the fact that not all scientific or technological endeavor is permitted. And he quotes a precedent that we mentioned at the very beginning. which is Kilayim. Even if you don't think like the Ramban, that Kilayim represents an idea of like fighting God's will in the world, there are still certain scientific things, certain kinds of mixing of plants, that is prohibited to us. I can't do anything I want in the world. I can do a lot of things in the world. It might be that creativity in nature is a value, but it's not the only value. There's some limit there. So, genetic engineering sounds great, but I know that I don't have complete carte blanche to do whatever I want in the world, so maybe there should be a limitation. He says the same thing is true for medicine. He quotes the precedent we mentioned of the Tiferet Yisrael. If there's no reason to prohibit something, shouldn't it be permitted? We know in medicine that isn't necessarily the case. And he quotes a lot of precedent in this second paragraph, in the last paragraph on page 45, in the top of 46, dealing with the issue of how we know that medical treatments are solid enough or reliable enough or appropriate enough to possibly invoke. And so even if you want to start from a perspective of if it's no reason to prohibit, it must be permitted, in medicine, maybe the balance is a little bit shifted. And we have to have the burden of proof on a medical decision being a good decision and a valid, legitimate one before we're able to kind of give the green light and the go-ahead for that issue. Let me just remind myself what he says in this... these last paragraphs, he mostly summarizes that point, so we'll just jump to the end of the page on page 46. Ha'ole mikol ha'amor hu, that which arises from all of the aforementioned issues, she'im yaskimu gedolei Yisrael, that if the gedolim agree to this, efshir yeh ulai limto heter b'mikrim bodedim shal shatz d'chak gedola. That's a lot of hedging, if I've ever heard it. It's possible that there will maybe be the ability to find a leniency in certain cases of extenuating circumstances. Like, that is like five hedges in the same sentence. It's very, very tightly framed. Kedei lahasil et havladot mibayot kashot, to save children from serious problems. So he means in medical context. He really, in his, you know, inclination, again, this is, you know, 20, 25 years ago, so it's possible his thought has changed on this matter as well. But his inclination is to limit it to the realm of medicine, and to leave this in the authority of the Gedolim, which is a new idea that we hadn't seen reflected in earlier sources, and that maybe, you know, unlike in other areas of religious life where the default is that it's permitted until proven otherwise, maybe we kind of shift direction, that we say, no, in medical spheres, we really tend to be much more hesitant in developing some of these halachic approaches as we see them. Okay, so just to quickly sikum and summarize what we've seen. We started with the, I would call them like more of the hashkafic piece, the more philosophical piece, that which is not necessarily as formally binding as halacha, but certainly valuable. And some of the values of playing God, the value of providing, you know, effective refuah, and also not going too far and getting involved in the Hadei Kavshi Derachman, all of God's divine secrets for how children are born and come into the world. And so perhaps giving us certain, you know, perspectives on where we think the Torah might go. We then took a step back and talked about like the meta-halachic ways of thinking about this issue. If there's no halacha, how does halacha come to be in dealing with issues that have no existing precedent? And we saw one treatment, and I'm sorry to see it just only in a broad strokes, of how to actually deal with the question on a substantive level. The question 25 years ago was theoretical in a way that it now isn't, and so one wonders where, you know, halacha will go in dealing with issues in the future, but I'm excited to see it play out. With that, I'll